If you don't say I am, nobody will say you are. Africa, Nigeria is allowing the world to tell their story.
So the US saw what the rest of the world did not see early. They saw that image is nothing, perception is everything. They built perception, and they did that through Hollywood.
They have built their economies around perception. So you watch an American movie, for instance, and the first thing that you see is that they always win. They paint that perception of superiority through movies, and then you believe. How do you know that the Air Force One is the most powerful jet in the world? You believe. Nigeria decided to export movies, and they come with Native Doctor. They come with Evil Stepmother, Wicked Uncle, Wicked Auntie, reflecting interesting stories, but building the wrong perception. How did Lagos become what it has become today, that is flooded with human beings? Why? Nollywood painted a picture that Lagos was the only place where you can become successful. So everybody says, Adego, Lagos. Perception is everything. What's happening today with Japan and all that is second level colonization. And what do we see? These economies were built by blacks 150 years ago. It's time for these economies to transit to the new world. We are in the fourth industrial revolution, where this technology and all that is taking center stage. The cradle of technology and talent remains in Africa. That's where you have the brightest minds. Now, these mines are now being potted. They are harvested and they are taken to go and develop the economy. We don't amplify our voices to create the perception that allows these giants to grow and still fit into the room. So what happens is that we build giants from the scratch. They become too big for us. They go to the bigger room.
Welcome to the Frankly Business Podcast. And this time around, I was having a conversation with Kelechi. If you don't know Kelechi, you don't know the Godfather Production, who is the vice president of the Godfather Production over there. The handsome gentleman. As a matter of fact, he's the producer and the co-host of the Frankly Business Podcast. But then I was having a conversation with him, and we're talking about what is really the objective of the Frankly Business Podcast. And here we go. We discovered that when you go to the top universities around the world, Ivy League colleges, you find out that when you're going for a course around business or you're going to a business school, what happens in those institutions is that they bring in people who are trailblaze different industries, and those guys actually come to those business schools, those Ivy League colleges, to teach you business. Not necessarily the professors. I'm sure that the professors are more or less just trying to tell you about the administrative part of business, but the core of business is actually being taught by people who have their skin in the game, who get their hands dirty every blessed day. I remember Tony Elumelu one time when he said he posted a viral content, and most of his contents actually go viral. That man is a he's a blockbuster. his brand alone is a blockbuster. But then he said something that some 20 years back, he was in Harvard Business School as a student, and now he's back in Harvard Business School as a lecturer, meaning that he's coming to teach students who are there to learn what it takes to build a business in the African landscape. And that's what business school is. And if you look at what is happening in the Nigerian education landscape, you see that we don't have that. Why? Because you go to the school to study business, what you get, what you always meet is tear a sheet of paper, tear a foolscap sheet. We have tests this particular day. What is the test all about? Are you testing the Nigerian markets? No. They're testing definitions, how to cram, la cram la pro. That is not really what happens in business. Business is more practical than theory. And that's why we have the Frankly Business Podcast. It's a mini Harvard. It's a mini Stanford. It's a mini Oxford, where you come to learn the business, not from me, not from Kelechi, but from the guests, the men who have been able to trailblaze different industry and been able to put their brands in the sands of time of business, how to build businesses. You're going to learn it from this man. And perhaps this particular episode is dedicated to founders, because this man we have on this episode of the Business Hour of the Frankly Business Podcast. You know why I said the Business Hour? As a matter of fact, I have a business show on VOP, Voice of the People TV, where we talk about issues hooping around the Nigerian business landscape. And it's called The Business Hour. That's why I said that. Anyways, that's a different kettle of fish. I have no other person. Before we go to our guest, let's talk about Kelechi. Kelechi, your head does the shine. Everything, you're making money. You're making money. Blockbuster ads, creating those ads. Refining what is happening.
We're not allowing the government get to us. We're focused on what we can control, which is self-care. But I was doing my research about our guest today, and I went to his Instagram page to look at what he has done, so I could also, you know, project my questions on how to channel the conversation. And I must say, I learned a new thing about startups entirely that you don't get to see in schools. I'm talking about our university system. I think they are out of touch with the current reality of the business world. I don't think they have education on tech. And most young people want to get into tech. Even the older generation are looking at even getting into tech, financing them and the rest. But that's why we are here, to fill in that gap and bring in this. An average course in a school is 1 hour. Like, an average class in a school is 1 hour. And our podcast is 1 hour. So, voila.
Welcome. So, we're bridging that gap.
We are bridging that gap.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think I've been able to go to school to learn how to pronounce his name. Yeah, our guest. And I'm going to get it right, but I'm not going to be fast. You know, I'm fast-paced, but I'm going to take it slow. His name is Omoruyi Edeogirare. I'm sure I'm one of the first persons that have gotten the pronunciation. Omoruyi Edeogirare, who's the lead partner of the Edeogirare and Company. Oh my goodness. You're very much welcome to the Franklin
Thank
Business
you.
Podcast.
Thank you for having me. I have tried to shorten it for everyone, so we lost. Right, but...
How many people do you meet that get the pronunciation of your son?
Very few.
Even people from Edo. I'm sure there are people from Edo that don't get it.
Very few. But what I say is, if you meet the average Russian, their names are very... But they will insist. And it's part of our identity as a people. You can't be more Nigerian than me. Right? And I'm very techie, very enlightened, very well-traveled. But I insist on my name. They said, don't you have an abbreviation? I said, you have an abbreviation for Shevchenko? Okay, when you get an abbreviation for that, then I'll think of abbreviating mine. So you've got to pronounce it. And so, if not, we lose our identity, you know, because some of our names can be tongue twisted. But yeah, I don't get where it is.
talking about identity, do you think that the younger generation are losing it? Let's stay on the topic before we...
Well, I think pop culture is a major distraction. And I think that what has happened is that we've had a fixation on the Western world. And so our understanding of pop culture is leaning on what the West calls it. Very few indigenous approach to pop culture, to new life, right? But we have our entertainment, music especially, to thank for still retaining some bit of our language, some bit of our dressing, and all that. So they give you a neat fusion of African. And I was joking with a friend that any hit song that doesn't have a Yoruba lyric in it has not started, right? So even though you're trying to speak Queen's English, but when you're singing Ashake, you get to one place and say, you know, all those kind of things, right? But we've got a lot of work to do, because I say to myself, my kids, it's summer soon. My kids are asking, oh, daddy, we're ready for vacation. Nobody's thinking of going to Benin or going to Obubukato Ranch or going to Yankari. They're looking at Disneyland. They're looking at Paris. They're looking at going to Florida, right? That's their attention. And so if I say to them, oh, we're going to Benin for summer.
To Hala.
Right? So, but how do you get to know your heritage if you're taking flight every time out? And even our cartoons, right? So you catch them young. How many indigenous cartoons do we have, right? Technology is not bespoke. Everything we're doing is, you know, we're borrowing leaf from the Western world. So It's a lot, but you now have to be intentional about, you know, parents want their children to speak Fune before learning to speak the language.
Yeah.
And I'm also guilty of it, right? So my daughter one day said to me, Ekaro, and I said, who taught you that? She said, we're learning Yoruba in school. All right, I said, calm down, right? And I felt bad because I should be glad, I should be excited. But I'm like, hey, I don't want your tongue to change. What's going on? You know, it's the relic of colonization. It has eaten so deep into us that we tend to think that an American accent, a British accent, is better than a Yoruba or an Igbo accent. So if I come here and I say, you know that I'm coming to buy that thing from you, you won't find it as exciting as, you know, I'm going to come buy that thing from you. Or what do you think, you know, when we look at it? Why? It's sweeter to us. But that's not who we are. English is not our language. It's our lingua franca, but it does not define our identity and our culture as a people. You are either Igbo, Yoruba, Efi, Hausa, Kanuri, different tribes. Right? So the Indian, for instance, will not speak English in a way that you want him to speak it. He will speak it reflecting his Indian accent.
And they're controlling, they're literally controlling more than half of Silicon Valley companies.
Of course. So if you understand technology, you understand that the Asian, the Indian extraction of Asia is overtaking a lot of things. And it's not even just in innovation and technology. They are giving China a run for their money in
so many ways.
Technology, in manufacturing, in everything.
Yeah.
Why? They understand the power of their numbers. So they go to the Western world, get the very best of education, and go back and innovate in their places, and then come back and sell to the Western world.
So I once had a conversation with Kel. Kel, you can testify to that. And we said that now Afrobeat is taking center stage. We're seeing Burna Boy, what he's doing. By the way, he shut down 80,000 capacity stadium in the UK. Like this week. Yeah, this week. Doing amazing numbers, making us proud. We're seeing what Budigido is doing across the world. Whiskey, even though I have my favorite, and it's still Burna. Still gotta stand with that guy. Love him, by the way. So, but what I'm saying in essence is we're having a conversation, and he said that. Why don't we have the Ministry of Tourism, Ministry of Arts and Culture, partnering with some of our Afrobeat pop stars and selling tourism to the world? You're seeing a Nigerian shutting down 80,000 capacity stadium in the UK. You know how much of a leverage that can be to sell tourism. And nobody goes to buy something that is not being sold. Nobody buys anything that is not branded. Yeah. I don't know if you get my point. Yeah. So it has to be a collective effort. And if the government pushes it, what did the government, why is the US that powerful? I mean, what is the most commodified product in the US? What do you need the US to export?
People.
It's their culture.
They're people. They're
As a matter of fact, the most commodified product from US is actually the US dollar, their currency. The next is their culture. And that's what has given them soft power. You can't conquer the world if you don't have soft power. You can have economic power, but if you don't have soft power, that's why they are beating China. They will forever win China. Why? Because an average non-Chinese is not interested in speaking Chinese. You get? So if you can't, that's how you control the world. They have to speak your language. They have to embrace your culture.
So the US saw what the rest of the world did not see early. They saw that image is nothing. Perception is everything. They built perception.
Perception is branding.
And they did that through Hollywood. You don't want to know the amount of challenges these countries face, right? I've been out of the country for about a month. And the number of homeless people, the number of beggars, the number of challenges I saw, I wanted to do a recording, and I said, no, just, you know, but you never see it. Because they have built their economies around perception. So you watch an American movie, for instance, And the first thing that you see is that they always win.
I've never seen it from
that. They paint that perception of greatness.
Yeah.
They paint that perception of superiority through movies, and then you believe. How do you know that the Air Force One is the most powerful jet in the world? Mm-hmm. You've been in one. But if I ask you now, you tell me.
They say that all the time in their movies.
Yeah.
All the time.
As a matter of fact, we've been talking about that.
You, well, you see, Africa, yeah. Nigeria decided to export their talent, right? Movies. Mm-hmm. And they come with Native Doctor. They come with evil stepmother, wicked uncle, wicked auntie, reflecting interesting stories, but building the wrong perception, creating the wrong perception. How did Lagos become what it has become today, that is flooded with human beings? Why? Nollywood painted a picture that Lagos was the only place where you can become successful. So everybody says, Adego, Lagos. Perception is everything. Listen, I can think that I am the best thing after sliced bread, right? If you perceive me as a houseboy, that's actually what I am. No matter how good you are, greatness is built heavily on perception, and that's where we've lost it. Nigerians are not selling ourselves. Right? But how would they, when the people who should sell that perception are the biggest stories themselves, are the biggest investors in the foreign land themselves? We've got to sell ourselves. What you have is human capital drain over time. So you come, I always say, look, ask all these A-list actors, A-list musicians, let them bring out their passports. If 10 bring out their passports, I'm not sure up to 4 will be green. What is happening? The Western world is
pulling them
in. We don't amplify our voices to create the perception that allows these giants to grow and still fit into the room. So what happens is that we build giants from the scratch. They become too big for us. They go to the bigger room. That's our reality. And Africa is a giant. Nigeria is a giant of Africa. I have traveled extensively. And there's no nightclub. There's no place you go into. You get into the Uber. You get into the car. The next song you're hearing is Afrobeats, Burna Boy, Asake, Davido, everybody. And it didn't just start now. Back then, even King Sonny Ade, even Oliver Dico. We've always led the pace in entertainment, in music. Our beats have always been interesting, but we are not selling that perception. We are building, and suddenly we get too big, we scale to the bigger room. The bigger room in the Western world.
Always UK.
And the Western world is smart. I always say, look, what's happening today with Japan and all that is second level colonization.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do we see? These economies were built by blacks 100 years ago, 150 years ago. It's time for these economies to transit to the new world. We are in the fourth industrial revolution, where this technology and all that is taking center stage. The cradle of technology and talent remains in Africa. That's where you have the brightest minds. Now, these minds are now being potted. They are harvested and they are taken to go and develop these economies. So you have a founder who starts somewhere in Saleko, building a unique product, scales, grows, makes money, and then the next thing, global talent, L visa, this visa, that visa, he's moved. He's taking that business, he's building the economy of that country. He's making more. He has all the buffers and support that he needs. He's not invested in this place. those economies are scaling and growing.
Let me give you a classic example of what you just said. I have a friend. I'm not going to mention his name because he's going to finish me from there. He got a job in an Egyptian firm. You know, the Egyptian firm, you know what they're paying him? Let me put it in context. Let me not say how much they're paying him, but for you to understand, they're going to cover the tuition fee of four of his kids up to university level in any university in the world. Four of his kids. Mm-hmm. Accommodation is covered. Mm-hmm. Official car for himself, mm-hmm. his wife, covered. Guess who owns this company? A Nigerian. Mm-hmm. But a Nigerian is there. The Nigerian said that he's not thinking of coming back now, but he has mm-hmm. the intention of coming back later. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if you saw a particular video. Tunde had not posted one point in time that a lady, a man is trying to set up a cancer facility in Nigeria. Here, it's currently in the US. He's done a lot. And he just thought about that. Why am I saving people here? And where my product is needed the most. If you look at maternal, what is happening to deaths of mothers
He's actually in Johns Hopkins.
He's resigning
to come to Nigeria and be like,
so Nigerians are trailblazing different industries. And it's just sad. Will you blame the people or you blame the government?
I blame everybody. who is the government? Government are the people.
So what's the way out?
He's the president of Nigeria from Mars. He's not in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. Was he born president? Was he not in Nigeria? Was he not a layman like you?
But there are some sort of people that will tell you they were born to be in power. They were born to rule.
Nobody was born in power.
It's a lingua. They say it and they live by that mantra. They say they were born to rule.
So that is everywhere. Abroad, right? In America, there's this school called BARD. There are some schools, I'm sure. There's Eton, for instance, you know Eton College, right? There are some schools where you are raised to become a president. The school has produced presidents, prime ministers, governors, members of Congress. You go there. If you don't have it in your blood to become a president, prime minister, congressman, or senator, they won't even bring you in.
We once had a school like that. What are we saying? You are even one of the alma maters of that school. Come on.
But you see,
and Casey,
the challenge that we face in building that trajectory is that in these economies and in these countries, you have people who have patriotism. Patriotism is a product of your government taking care of you. When your government fails to take care of you, you'll be silly to continue to be patriotic. You will now look at self first. So you enter what you call the self-preservation mode. Let me preserve myself first. When I have preserved myself, before I can now think of the larger picture. Do you understand me? So where you are, if you are starving, right, and you are in front of the food store, and you have the access to open it to feed everyone in this room, the first thing you will do is to eat. And then if you are smart, like you are with this, your beer, the next thing you will do is to say, I don't want to starve again. So you store up enough to prevent you from starving before you now give them the leftover. And that is what we call self-preservation. And that's what has been the bane of Africa and leadership on Africa.
I have a question. I was talking to a friend yesterday, a colleague from work. She's South African. And I said, I saw your election. Does it reflect the choice of the people? She said, not really, but we have a government. I'm like, but there's 60% voters turnout. I feel it's a win for the nation. And she was like, yes, it's a win for the nation. I said, in Nigeria, for the past three elections, we have under 25% voters turnout. So in a situation whereby we have 78 to 79 million eligible voters, and only 25 are coming out every day. Do you think it's lack of patriotism, or do you think the people have lost faith in the politician that everybody is just looking for themselves?
That's what I'm saying. Patriotism is faith in the country, faith in the institutions of the country that it can take care of you, that you're proud of it,
yeah,
that it has done well for you, right? Or faith that all will be well. But you see, the challenge that you face over time with our clients is that our patriotism has waned. So what's the patriotism of a civil servant who works for 35 years, retires, is not paid their gratuity, is not paid their pension, and, you know, has to take care literally of everything in our life or his life? And then you are begging to be paid your pension. You see, you know, all those videos of pensioners carrying placards and all that. What do you think those in government will be thinking of doing? Those that are in active service, what do you think they'll be thinking of doing?
Stealing.
So, but I think I have a contrary opinion to that, especially when it has to do with pensions, because we had one of the episodes of the Business Now, we had Tunji Andrews, who is the founder of Arba, one of the pension tech in this country. They're thriving. 11,000 customers without billboard, no ads, and all that. Mm-hmm. It tells you what they're doing in the market. But he came and he said that the reason why we had that happening, a lot of pensioners going to the government, crying, you see them every now and then, is because in the past, it wasn't a contributory system. It was more or less like the government saying, okay, work for 35 years, and because you work for 35 years, we'll take care of you after 35 years of pay, after 35 years of service. But there was nothing on the balance sheet to be able to cater for that. You get, there's no vacuum anywhere. You have to, if you put in, you have to, before you impute determines output. Mm-hmm. And so governors are seeing it as a favor. They are doing the senior citizens a favor if they are paying pensions, because it's not even contributory. It is now that we're experiencing contributory pension scheme where you're working and from your salary, a portion of it is being contributed and is going to the PFA, to your pension and funds accounts. It's going to, you know how these things are being done. So in the past, it wasn't contributory. Now it is contributory. And out of that contribution that you've done in the past 35 years is what they're going to use in paying you. And the money even doesn't go to the government.
No, the contribution is even both ways.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. From the salary and from the
government.
But you see, from the person you're working for,
yes, if it's that's private sector. A percentage from the person, a percentage also, government also makes a percentage, right? Yeah. And if you are working for private sector, your salary and your employee make up the... But you see, the point is, a country that wants to thrive must take care of its elderly population. If you don't take care of your elderly population, you're screwed. Because the young population can see. If I see that you came in here and the producer flogged the hell out of you, you think I'll come in? Are you getting my point?
Yeah.
It is the people you see in front of you. My mother says, only fools learn from experience. You should learn from another person's experience. What have the people before you suffered? When you learn from them, you mitigate the mistakes you will also make. Everyone makes their mistakes. But oftentimes, listen, there's nothing that's due.
True.
So the bane we have and the biggest dent on our patriotism index is the lack of a social safety net. Healthcare, education, housing. Why do people steal? To buy a house, to send their children to good schools, to afford affordable healthcare. Right? If we had qualitative public schools, I'm paying in six figures for my children to go to school. Kindergarten, primary. Six figures. I went to a public school. I cannot wish it on my children that they will go to a public school. You go to a public hospital, you're on your own. How many people today can say, I will work for 5 years, 10 years, and I'll raise money to build a house?
With the rising inflation, I have doubt.
So these are the social safety net index. How you gauge it? We don't have it. Abroad, you have the system that can give you a house. Once you have a job that pays you steady, your mortgage goes, you have a house. You could affordable healthcare. You only go to private schools in the Western world where you are a special needs child or you are from the very, very rich.
Yeah, right. Okay, do you feel, now let's go deep into the conversation of today.
Yeah.
So do you feel entrepreneurship for Africans is the way for us to take back the country?
Of course. That's the only way. What every other thing has failed us, the only thing that has not failed us is human capital, talent. And I think that what we have as a people is that the tighter it becomes, the more ingenious we become. We've got grit. The biggest thing the African has, the Nigerian entrepreneur has, is grit. It's to be able to keep going. It's to reinvent yourself. It's to survive despite the fact that you don't have the buffers that enable qualitative life. You're surviving. You're thriving. You're moving. Right? And that's why the Western world are increasingly amazed. Listen, if the trains stop working in America, there'll be a problem. But if Danfo says today that they won't work, people will still get to the office. Everywhere is flooded. People are on their way to work. Some have gotten to work. In certain countries, they're calling
emergency. State of emergency.
No, what? We can't work. Why do you think that so many people from our own times now are moving there? Because as their environment gets a bit more difficult, they can't understand certain things that we can understand. We can navigate those challenges. And so we're going there to take those jobs.
Mm.
All we have working for us is our talent. Unfortunately, like Frank had pointed out earlier, government is not creating the greatness perception index for the indigenous Nigerian African talent. There is no destination Nigeria. Every international conference you go to today, you are seeing Dubai. Now Saudi Arabia has thrown their hat in the ring. So where you go, you see Saudi boots, you see them curating a picture. What are we selling? What you now have is Uyi, Frank, Kene, right?
Yeah.
Selling their own stories. And then for the third party to now decide to either connect it to Nigeria or connect it to wherever. As against Nigeria painting the picture. You see, let me tell you something, eh? Samu Mbakwe back then said, look, if you don't say I am, nobody will say you are.
Mm.
Africa, Nigeria, is allowing the world to tell their story. And I cannot tell Kenneth's story in a way that will make Kenneth greater than me. I'm not Jesus Christ. I will tell Kenneth's story, amplify Kenneth's skill and talent, but in a way that it will not demystify my greatness. Hmm. But Kenneth can tell his story as flamboyantly as he wants to.
Mm.
You can do that. I'm not Jesus Christ. I can't love you more than I love myself. And the same thing, when you look at the ecosystem, you look at the growth, you look at the development that are coming from founders, founders are building for foreign investors to come and invest in. Founders, I cannot come and give you money for you to build and develop your country. I will give you money for you to build a product that suits my perception and most likely will be more effective
abroad.
So I can hear some names. You just said that. We'll take a break, but before we take that break, I can hear some names. I just heard you mention IMF, World Bank.
I didn't mention
any name. I can hear you say that. You know, these guys, let's take a break. We'll come back. Ladies and gentlemen, the Frankly Business Podcast. Welcome back to the Frankly Business Podcast. So I said that I could hear some names. I heard you mentioning the IMF, but you had mentioned them in proxy, by proxy, the World Bank, the EU. When they give you money, they give you loans, they say, oh, You're coming to change your paradigm. You're coming to change your economy. Coming to put butter on your bread. But there is always, nobody gives you something to become better than them. Is that, let
you
me.
Said, you said you, you had to that
nobody give you, you see, listen.
There's no lunch in free, no free lunch in free time. Everything has got a price. Everything, nothing is free. Listen, even love is not free.
Even the gospel is not free.
The gospel is not free. Jesus paid the ultimate price for us to have salvation. So when they tell you salvation is free, it's free because Jesus has paid. God had to come down to die for us to be saved. Ultimate price. Blood had to be shed. Nothing is free. So when you receive funding, okay, let's go back. What is the problem with Africa? Africa has had a serious crisis in leadership where our leaders approach the Western world from a beggarly status. And I say it is an effect of colonization.
Can I step in? I saw Nana Akufo, the current president of Ghana, when he ran his campaign, he was the U.S., I think they stepped in on his branding because he was speaking on major platform and he came in and said, we don't want to be beggars and stuff and stuff. We want to take back Africa. We want to come with values and the rest. And they started messing around with some cocoa policies. They started doing some cocoa policies to favor the Ghanaian farmers, Cote d'Ivoire farmers and the rest. Then, you know, the Western community did? They dropped their credit rating. So they dropped their credit rating. Ghana economy tumbled. Now Nana Akufo is you don't even see him in conferences anymore.
Look at Zimbabwe. Mugabe.
Yeah.
What did Mugabe try to do? Mugabe wanted to give Zimbabwean blacks back their farmlands. Zimbabwe has yet to suffer. It's yet to recover.
Libya too.
Right? But let's not go there, right? Because you also, the Western world relates with you the way you have painted yourself. You can't rubbish yourself and expect respect. Respect is reciprocal. You can't come. You see, what we don't realize is that these guys are ahead of us because they have taken time to build systems. And so they study us and they study our language. And then look at the level of political instability. That is a product of our mindset and our thinking. So they give you what you have earned, not what you ask for. So you can go and make those fine speeches. Have you earned the upgrade from beggy beggy? Africa leaders continue to shop around the world literally begging for aid. And when the aid comes, corruption deals it a heavy blow. Accountability index is low. And the Western world know this. When we get into the startup funding, one of the things you realize is that investors, the due diligence sheet that is used in Europe, in North America, is different from the one used in Nigeria.
Whoa.
Questions may be 10 there. Questions here will be 100. Documentary overview may be 5 or 6 there. Here, it will be over 100. They even say, make you go bring your grandmother's birth certificate.
So, but why?
In the integrity, okay. Our integrity index is also problematic.
Let us move into the startup ecosystem. So the reason why we're moving there is because, for those who are watching, this man you see sitting here on our famous couch is really the brainwork behind most startups. He's the system and structure. Go and find out yourself. You can follow him across social media platform and find out yourself. Anyways, we're going to come into that. I knew there was one time you were telling me you beat one of the biggest companies in Nigeria in the courtrooms, orange in color. One of the biggest banks.
I'm not going to go there.
Let's. But what I'm saying in essence is, the startup ecosystem. You talked about funding, and with funding, last week a particular story went viral. I don't know if you saw it. Mara, one company I'm going to mention, it's viral. The
$25 million.
As it, they were paying themselves as high as 100 million naira per month. 45 million naira per month, all the directors and per month. I'm telling you, the one of the guys that made a comment. One of the guys said that they share the same workspace and that these founders, they come in with mopo. That the driver has his own official car.
France.
Driver has his own official car. And yes, when stories like this go viral, sometimes they're a bit of exaggeration, but in every rumor, there's always an element of truth. And you see the lifestyle of some of all the startup founders, especially after the raise funds. Not knowing that, I remember one of the tweets that Akin Lebis made mention, the founder of Nairabet. He said he's currently on the floor of the National Assembly. He said that this startup ecosystem, something has to be brought into, a lot of balances have to be brought into the playing field, in the sense that the most important fund is not the investor's fund. The most important fund in your business is the customer's fund. If you're getting a lot from the customers, you can chill in the Bahamas.
You can't also chill in
the Bahamas. Yes, no, I'm saying that if your profit margin is so large, you can you question anything? Bezos does, or can you question anything the founder of Nvidia does?
Let's go there.
I don't know if you get my point. They are chilling with investors' funds. What is your take about this whole thing happening in the startup
ecosystem? You know.
I don't know.
You know my take. So, for instance, by the grace of God, I have helped build at least at the very least 1,000 companies, and at least 300 to 325 of them can be categorized as startups in the real sense of the word. I understand the environment, and I know the language, and I know the behavioral patterns. And I can tell you, and I have always maintained, that investor funds should be a buffer. What should keep a startup afloat should be market sustainability, product market fit, and market sustainability. Investor funds is not Christmas dash. Investor funds is supposed to help the business scale or serve as a buffer. Now, there are some startups that are really not profit-oriented, but they are innovation-driven in order to be able to create a new lease and phase of life to improve processes. Those sort of startups require investments for them to be able to thrive, right? But there is microcosm, minus 5% of the number. The actual startups, if your product does not have a market for it, you have no business seeking investment. And I will say, investor funds should not be used to cover overhead costs, pay salaries, pay rent, do these sponsor events, except you can show a clear nexus to market expansion through these things. What we see are people marketing ideas in their head and asking people to bring out monies from their pockets. It doesn't work that way.
But there have been
there's a thin line between that and 419. You think I cannot think of a brilliant idea and go to the founder of VOX Media and speak big English and have him release money? I was saying to you, due diligence.
If I, chairman, no go give you shishi.
Do you understand me?
Now, yeah.
That's a major problem. Because what you have are people who are not looking at the market, but are looking at investors.
They're building for
valuation. So everywhere you go, you see them talking of funding. And I asked them, what's your market penetration index? When we get funding, we're able to do this. They always take you back to funding, the fact that they need funding. Today, $100,000 USD is nothing to the average founder. They're talking of $1,500,000, you know, and all that. And it's creating a dangerous precedent in the ecosystem where the average newcomer into the ecosystem believes that if I don't get funding, I can't build a successful startup.
But I think I want to play the devil's advocate here in that instance, because you see it happen in the US, the so-called
We've copied too much. But let me explain to you.
Do you know how much went into Facebook?
Look at WeWork.
Do you know how much WeWork raised?
WeWork has crashed.
More than $100 million.
But are you aware that WeWork crashed?
It crashed. Yes,
and it crashed dangerously. It crashed so bad that over 10,000 people lost their jobs.
Yes.
And billions of dollars in investment. In fact, WeWork was a playbook for fraud. Until the investors started calling out, asking for details, and reviewing, it was another Enron.
Yeah, it was actually.
So let's don't go to WeWork.
Okay.
Now see, so let's look at our dynamics. There's something called bootstrapping.
Yeah.
Listen, I tell my investors, right? You ask me to advise you on investment, first thing I tell you is how much have the founders bootstrapped? How much has gone in? Verifiable. I can tell you I've spent $50 million. Can you verify that investment? Put your money where your mouth is. A lot goes into building a startup, and we must give it to founders. A lot goes into building a startup. It takes a lot of energy. However, we must start curating conversations, encouraging founders to look more towards the market. And that when you get investment, the investment is to help you scale, expand your market reach, improve your product sustainability, and not start building. And not overhead. Listen, Jeff Bezos is one of the richest men. If he's not the richest, it's always between him and Elon, right?
Yeah.
Now, what happened? For 9 years, They didn't share profits. He didn't get a dime. But what happened? By the second year, they had already gone public. Second or third year, they were already public. They already had IPO. They already had $1 billion investments. But the founders remained, Jeff and his guys remained, put their head to the ground and continued to boost market expansion. What we have in some quarters is you get your first $1 million USD, you go and buy a house in Ikoyi. You buy G Wagon. You fly business class.
Have you heard that? It's an AMG.
That one will pull money out of
you. Now, you see, you can't build a sustainable entity. I always say, look at the traditional businessmen. We were talking about Tony Lumelu when you started, right? How did these guys build their businesses? Look at Cosmos Maduka.
Herbert Wigwe.
Herbert. How did they build their businesses?
Yeah.
Right? It takes time. Facebook was already a $1 billion company. Mark was still living in the basement. When did he buy his house?
I have a question. Sorry to cut you.
Is it a mindset?
No, so it's African. So here's what's affecting us. Is the African need for flamboyance.
For sure.
Is the perception that until I look flamboyant, I am not successful.
Well, you said it now.
Perception is branded.
So the thing about it is, perception is branding, right? But greed. There's a difference between trying to create a perception and being outrightly greedy. If you are a founder and you come to me
right? And we are doing due diligence on you. And I see clearly that you're living above your means. I would tell the investors not to invest. No matter the perception I want to create, because I cannot tie your product market sustainability index to the lifestyle you're living. So you say to investors today, how much, what's the leadership earning? Is it sustainable? Is it sustainable? If you speak to Tony Elumelu, when he was GMD of Standard Trust and when they started, were they earning exorbitant salaries? It doesn't work that way. So what you have is that if you run before you walk, you will come back and walk.
One of my billionaire mentors says that, shout out to Chairman Ifeanyi, he says that you don't grow big to manage, you manage to grow big.
So I always say lean, starting lean. For instance, Larry Page said, if he comes to your startup, right, and sees that you are in a big place and all that, something is wrong in the early years. You see, there is a gift in starting small and scaling. It teaches you discipline. It teaches you frugality. It teaches you management and integrity, builds integrity. Any startup that starts with a bang ends with a bomb. They just blow up. Wah. Go and look at it. Go and look at how did Amazon start. It started in his garage. By the way, he started building Amazon with bootstrapping from his parents' investors' retirement funds. That's what Jeff uses to build Amazon. $250,000, which were his parents' retirement benefits they gave him to start Amazon. In my mind, I was just like, ha, I'm going to say this business failed. Right? But that's it. Started from his garage. And then as you get customers, as the business starts growing, you start saying, okay, maybe we need to move to a bigger space. Right? Where our numbers are building, we have a market, right? Maybe we need to move. What you have are people saying, for people to respect us, I have to have office in Banana Island. When your product and the market is in Eko Edumota.
So you're even far from your market.
Or is in Trade Fair, Alaba International. Or is in Oshodi. Or is in Yaba. Right?
You can't blame them.
You see, until you realize
that
being a founder, running a startup, is not a buzzword. It's not a trendy thing. It's not what you want. It's not what's cool. It actually works.
It is.
Right? Now, there's also another angle to the conversation, which is that founders put in a lot of work as they are building. And so when these investments come in, some of them are unable to delay gratification. Because I've suffered. It's a valid point.
I think I would love to say something to that effect. We had Kelvin Imejiku, the founder of Bumper. They raised $4 million. We had him on the fourth episode or one of those episodes? Yeah. And he said he was playing the air regarding LaserPay and what's the name?
Payday.
You know, Fever.
Mm-hmm.
There was an issue and they were like, Fever was paying either one of them. Let me get my facts right. Either founder of LaserPay or Payday.
Was earning
close to like $16,000 monthly. Yada yada, was living large and all that. And funny enough, we had this guy, Kelvin. Kelvin is so close to Fever, and he said what really happened was that he told Fever that, Fever, when you were starting up, pay yourself. Fever said no. He was working for Microsoft then. And he said, no, there's no need. I'm earning. There's no need. Blah, 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 yada, yada. I will bootstrap. I'll do this. I'll pay the price now. And when funds came in and they were a bit stable, he started paying himself all the monies that he has not earned all this while. Mm-hmm. And it was just for 5 months, right? He came here and he cleared the air and said it was just for 5 months. And you know how we in the media now, we like to add adjust that to some things. This thing just blew out of proportion. It went viral, went trendy. And people were talking. And you know, when people say they're paying themselves 10K, just know that by the time it gets to the fourth person who is talking about that rumor,
it's not 100K.
It's not 100K. So always fact check. So what I'm saying in essence is, it's just tantamount to what you're saying, mm-hmm. that some people they paid the price, we've grinded, and when the money comes, then we'll be chalk buffet, confirm
so,
buffet.
So here's the thing, delayed gratification is one of the biggest gifts you can give yourself as a founder. But you see, there is a myth that is becoming a fact because so many people are painting that narrative in the ecosystem. The myth of failure, that it's okay for the startup to fail and that most startups will fail. So that gives a sense of comfort that, okay, if this business fails, and failure in itself is not a bad thing, right? Businesses fail to grow. You know, you ask the average founder, they've tried their hands on so many things before they struck gold,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
However, that perception that, okay, I can get $1 million and then the business can still fail. Who will pay that $1 million? But you know the problem? Let me tell you the truth. Many founders have not started going to jail.
Oh.
They've not started facing court cases.
Oh.
They've not started answering the investor questions. When they start, the chickens will come home to roost.
So do you think for growth we need regulation?
So the thing is, every industry must build a way to self-regulate.
But you were part of the people that set up the startup bill.
The startup act.
So the startup act. And I'm going to
Act is not a regulator.
Are you saying
it's an enabler?
Yes, it's an enabler. But was that a part of the act?
There is enough regulation. The Companies and Allied Matters Act has its own regulation for
Security
companies.
And Exchange Commission.
SEC have their rules. CBN have their regulations, right? You have the corporate governance code. These are all regulations that are targeted at companies, of which startups are also inclusive, right? And so there's a due diligence framework that is an offshoot of having a corporate governance system. The challenge we have is that many startups don't have a corporate governance structure. So for instance, you can pay yourself what you like because there are no accountability indexes across. Your audited accounts, who are you submitting your audited accounts to?
So who steps in and hold them accountable?
Oh, so right now, the system is the investors who are now investing are now asking more difficult questions beyond your business idea, beyond your product market fit, beyond your potential market. They are now asking, who's in your board? Do you have a board? Are you holding board meetings? Do you have a structure in place? Can I see your audited accounts? Can I see your pay slips? These are questions that many founders previously overlooked.
So the ones in the past, investors in the past were not asking this question.
The focus was on the idea, the novelty of the idea, the importance of it, and the fact that you needed to encourage.
So do you blame the investor or you blame the founder? Because if the investor, the first metric for you to be an investor is actually Dior. Do your own research.
So let me cut you short there.
Yeah.
When you talk about startups, these are companies that literally don't have a track record beyond their idea. And the idea around investing in startups was to help businesses that are new grow and not die, encourage innovation. If you go to a traditional banking institution and tell them you need funding for your startup, they will ask you questions, ask you to bring documents that you cannot get. You will not meet their threshold. They will give you money at interest that you can't pay.
It's 30% now.
Right? So the idea for investment, and that's why you had VCs. What VCs come in? VCs come in, they fund you, then they take equity in your company.
They share the risk with you.
Right? And then But now VCs are becoming tough. They are not just taking equity. They are now even the directing minds in your company. But the challenge for that is that it stifles your innovation. Because if I have come and give you $1 million for you to do X, you cannot pivot to Y. I'm going to hold your throat, bro. Also, investment is particular to investors. My donor thesis or my investor thesis may be to fund startups in XYZ. And if you're in XYZ lane, I fund you. You cannot now move from XYZ to ABC. It becomes a problem. So the issue of money, investment, due diligence, how much due diligence do you want to do to a new company that's just starting but with a brilliant idea? If Larry Page and his co-founder, if Kazanik, the founder of Uber, if even Jeff Bezos were taking through stringent due diligence processes, I doubt that the startups that have now become large, large conglomerates will be alive today. You've got to give them, there must be that element of trust and belief that this is capable of being the next big thing. The challenge we have is that that element of trust is being abused by certain financial malfeasance, by act of indiscretion, by unnecessary funding, which we must now correct by a more stringent due diligence process. You had asked me on the Frankly Business Show what the startups need. And I said I could reel out all the documents. I have them in my head. But it's not going to help them. What do you need? Go to a professional as you're starting and let that professional handhold you through the process. There is no artist that has made it in the entertainment space in this country that did not have a strong manager. Burna Boy is the greatest. You have to go through his mother before you get to him. Mm-hmm. And she's as hard as a rock. And she's firm and tough. Why do you now think that as a startup you can go on your own? Can go to Google and download agreement templates.
As a matter, but you can watch it on
and then you sign an agreement that the dispute resolution clause is in California, and you are in Isaleko. When the problem comes, you go and fly to California because Nigeria does not have any jurisdiction in resolving that dispute. But you see, we must understand that our journey as startup and as founders is that of trust. That is built on integrity. No business is built without that integrity quotient. Now, Zuckerberg realized that, look, all I know is technology, this is my thing. What did he do? He went and brought one of the leading administrators in Fortune 500 to come and run Facebook. So stayed away from day-to-day management and focused on innovation. Steve Jobs built Apple. He was a key visionary of, but it did not have a single bone of administration.
Is this Steve? What's next? I mean,
Jobs.
No. This the guy that is there. What's his name? The present
Tim Cook.
Tim Cook does not have an innovation bone in his skin, but as far as administration is concerned, you can't question him. So a Tim and a Steve built the Apple of today that you can see.
So
as a founder, you must also know your limits. Many founders are dabbling into administration that they know nothing about. That's why you're having harassment issues, financial challenges. And some of these things are an honest mistake. Sometimes they don't know better. If they knew better, they would do better. If you're an innovator, stay in your lane as an innovator and innovate.
Was that not why we have the idea of, I think is it a part of the bill? The idea of founder and co-founder, and you have to complement each other. If I'm an administrator, you're supposed to be the person You're supposed to be a marketer. You're supposed to be the person behind the business. You're supposed to be the innovator. If I'm a techie, then I'm supposed to handle the business of the business. You have a book called The Business of,
Running Your Business. So I have a very different view as far as co-founder relationships are concerned.
Okay.
It's like marriage. If you get it right, sweet. You get it wrong, you're screwed. Many startups have died today as a result of co-founder conflicts.
But like marriage, you can remarry.
And often, yes. But you see, you can remarry, but the marriage is dead. Right? You're starting another one. No matter how much potential that marriage had, it's dead. Same thing with startups. Oftentimes, that a person has a skill set that is needed by your startup at the inception does not mean that person should be your co-founder. The person could be a freelance consultant. The person could be a high-level employee. The person could also even be an equity employee, but you could give the employee, have a stock option arrangement where you give him vested shares over time, right? That is there. But what we have is I'm building something. Frank has this magic I need at this time. Frank, come and be my co-founder. Do you both have a meeting of minds as to how this startup should run? As to the future of this startup? As to how money should be shared? Kenneth and Frank are building a startup, right? Frank is a long-term guy. Okay, we've made $1 million. Let's invest all these $1 million into the business and see what we make. My projection is that in 5 years, we can convert this $1 million to $50 million or to $20
million. But Kelechi, he lost his in the Bahamas.
Kene already has, throughout the 1 year of building, Kene had been dreaming of going to
Maldives.
Kene has this girl that told him he won't amount to anything in life.
Oh,
wow. So Kene wants to pepe her. He has already gone to price G-Wagon. So his own point is, Frank, give me my 50%. I own 50% of this company.
I am. You saw it.
Give me my 50% of this money. Let me go and do my thing. Mm. I have worked. Your long term is your business. Now, how did that happen? Mm. We can laugh about it, but there was no proper structure to the co-founder relationship. No co-founder agreement. At ENC Legal, one of the things that we have is what we call the difficult conversation. We have a list of bespoke questions. You'll never find it anywhere else. Where we send partners, co-founders, potential co-founders, go and have these questions, discuss among yourself, and then answer these questions, come back to us, we'll use it to prepare your founders agreement. 70% of the time, they'll come back and say,
"His marriage will not work
with this guy." No. This guy is not that. No. Thank God, though. Praise God. Can I run this thing alone? I need time. I need another co-founder. Now, if we didn't have that relationship, if we didn't push them to have that conversation, they would jump in and draft a Google-generated agreement, or they just call any lawyer and say, please help us draft the founder's agreement. Yeah. How about we draft a simple agreement and give them, they will sign and they will start the journey. Then Kasala will start busting little by little. We say we feel speak pidgin abi. And then the conversation they should have had at the onset, they are having it in the middle. But the challenge now is that there's a business, there's money, there's a market, there are customers,
there are investors
who will suffer as a result of their inability to agree on very, very important issues.
Okay, so you just mentioned reasons startups fail. One, financial misappropriation. Then two, co-founder issues. What like another deal breaker you should look out for?
Fragmented regulation. Many startups don't know the regulation, don't know the laws that regulate their business. So everybody just comes in, and until you get the next letter from the regulator, before you know that what they are asking of you. Because sometimes even the regulators cannot keep up with the pace of innovation and technology. So regulation is also evolving as far as startups are concerned. So oftentimes you build products on a faulty foundation because you're not aware of the regulation that you're working with, and now comes in and becomes a problem. And then also pop culture. We don't understand that we must contextualize our products to fit the market. So something is happening. A lot of the card businesses are folding. Many card payment generated businesses. Mm. You know, is it Carbon or they just shut down their card operations and all that. A lot of
it
them
are out later.
And all that. Why? Now let me give you a bit of a background. Many of these innovative businesses start not with profit at the center because they have some support and some funding, right? So they get the business and they get it running. Hopefully that the market will catch on and then it will become very profitable. But then the market doesn't catch on and then they have to shut down. One reason for this is that they don't contextualize our realities. Any technology you are building today with sole reliance on internet penetration, except you are building it around key cities, it will fail. Because our internet penetration is less than 40%. In fact, it's even in the early 30s.
But we're one of the highest in Africa.
Nigeria is 230 million people at the last census. So 30% of us is predominantly more than most African countries. There are still places in this country where you have to climb trees to be able to get telephone service.
Whoa.
You don't know? So, in fintech, for instance, what you have is predominantly founders are building products around the 46% of Nigerians that are financially included, still leaving out that 54% of people that don't have financial inclusion.
But they run with their branding message, run with backing the unbanked.
So let's understand. So if you are banking the unbanked in one village that does all have internet through a service that requires internet, how are you going to bank that unbanked? Any technology, financial technology that does not require, that do not utilize USSD or SIM technology is going to fail.
But let's leave the fintech. It looks like the attention of startup is around fintech.
Because it's easy.
There are a lot of easy.
You can build a fintech in your room. You can stay inside your room, you can build a fintech.
So let us do the hard things. Let's do the hard things. Because why am I saying this? If you look at what is happening, how many fintech startup do we want to have?
Yeah, all of them are servicing the same demographic.
The same demographic.
So you are moving from one platform to the next, to the next and next.
I'm taking from Peter to pay Paul. I'm taking from Paul to pay Peter. And it's not becoming a bubble. Everything is busting. And what is really happening? Don't we have the agri sector? What are we doing there? That's a massive vacuum. There are lots of problems in that sector. Look at what is happening in logistics. Lots of problems in that sector.
Yeah.
Look at what is happening in health. Lots of problems. Education is even the biggest deal in Africa, because if you look at, if we can solve the issue of education, most of them will not have 1 hour 30 minutes on the Frankly Business Podcast, because a lot of people will be enlightened. There will be little problems to really discuss.
But they'll tell you Nigeria don't
read. EduTech is also there.
So
health tech is there.
So you have that copycat. Like I said, remember I said at the beginning, and I don't speak in vacuum. So I want you to always contextualize things I have even previously said and connect them. One of the challenges that we have in the ecosystem are not people necessarily innovating to solve problems, but some are innovating to be part of a class because it's the in thing, right? And then some are innovating around what they understand. If I understand fintech, that's what I will innovate around. That's what I will build my startup around. You can't tell me to go and do edtech. I don't understand EdTech. Now, the challenge with this other underutilized aspects, right, is also our level of education. What is the education we have in Nigeria today? Go to school, get a degree, get a job. Very little fixation on skills.
But it's around the world, except China.
No. I beg to differ.
It's around the world.
I beg to differ. Today, global education is fixating heavily on skills.
But Americans are crying. There's a massive skill gap in the US. That's why we're seeing Indians coming in to fill up those gaps. So, Africans are going there to fill up those gaps.
So,
the UK, skills gap. How many carpenters do they have? How many plumbers do they have? Plumbers are big deals there.
Those are not even the skills we are looking at. Now, but before I go there, let me speak to this issue. One area that is dying in Nigeria today is the artisan aspect of service delivery. A lot of the plumbers are getting old and retiring and dying. A lot of the traditional electricians are getting old. A lot of those small carpenters, those small jobs. And I'm not seeing a crop of the next generation take over. You still have plumbing issues in 30 years, no matter how much technology, you still shit. You still have plumbing issues. You still use your water system. Yeah. You still, use the kitchen sink. And so you will still need plumbing. Robots will come and fix the pipe for you. Human beings will. Robots may be able to define how production is done faster, but the actual troubleshooting will predominantly be done by you or an artisan. And that's one aspect that continues to suffer a heavy hit. Because today, for you to get a plumber, even in Lagos, you have to start calling this one. I don't move to my village. I don't own. I don't try. And all that. You're seeing a lot of that.
Yeah, mechanics.
Right? Mechanics and all that. Because in this skilled informal sector, there is no training of the next generation.
Are they willing to learn?
The thing is, it continues to, it's not, it does not look attractive. It does not look like a hallmark of success. Mm. It doesn't look like what you want to become.
Yeah.
Right? But that's because of how it's been painted. Right? Nobody will tell you, a plumber will tell his child, I'm being a plumber, you must not be a plumber. You have to go to school, get a job and work in Shell.
And drill.
As against saying, look, this plumbing business that is starting from this place, you should be able to build a whole building. That's what the Israelis do.
Mm. Mm.
You send your child to Harvard to go and learn business education, learn technology, get all the necessary, come back, take that business to the next level, but keep the business going. What we do, we go, we train our children to go do something else, and the business dies with that family. Or it moves to one, Koshari said something about the one boy system. It remains the most business impactful training that Africa has ever seen, the apprenticeship system. Because you go through the entire rudiments, but most importantly, you retain the business. If not for the one boy system, the apprenticeship system, many businesses today would have been extinct. So tell me how agritech will boost if I don't understand and I have not built skills in that space. I understand technology. So let me tell you, many people in the agritech space understand the technology component of agritech. Very few understand the physical component of the agritech space.
Getting their hands dirty.
So we like to sit behind a computer. So oftentimes people think that startups are people who just sit behind computer and continue to code and build, and all that. Startups get their hands dirty on the field. What is a startup? In the definition of the Startup Act, a business that is technology development or innovation driven. And it's not restricted to digitization. That's the biggest challenge. Lagos State has a logistic nightmare challenge. We've not been able to get it right. Because how many people are taking time to understand skills around the actual bottlenecks we face? You see, we can continue thinking that digitization will solve our problem. One person will sit and develop a code and then we will just become heaven on earth. It can't work. You have to go to the field. You have to get your hands dirty. You have to understand how the field works and then tie that to the back-end digitization in order to get impactful results. And that's why, so why fintech is able to be so pronounced is that a lot of it falls back on digitization. There's very little field work. Yeah. Everything is numbers, codes, systems. In fact, I would say that the financial industry relied on artificial intelligence before artificial intelligence became a thing. So we must not take out that physical component to the conversation. Education must now start fixing. Everybody must not be a graduate. Everybody must not get a degree. A person can decide that my trajectory is to learn plumbing, learn carpentry. And I would do for the next 8 years, go through the skill sets I need to become the very best version. And I'll bring value. But you see, in this part of the world, we see it as a taboo. In fact, in my mind, as I'm saying this thing, I'm saying viewers may now say, why you not send your children to go do carpentry? In my mind, I say, God forbid. We cannot, you see, let me tell you, we cannot deceive ourselves. We must tell ourselves the truth. If everybody gets a degree and everybody is a degree holder, who will get the society running?
Should we turn our polytechnic to vocational
studies? Exactly. So, in fact, it's too late. How many skills did you learn in uni?
Babbing here.
How many did you learn in primary?
You did Bab.
That's why he said it like this. Oh! How many did you learn in primary and secondary school?
I'm not spending money again.
No. Well, you know, do you know where you learn faster? Mm. Primary and secondary.
Intro tech. Carpentry.
Intro tech was his a punishment. Intro tech was a punishment. Right? It was a compulsory subject in GSS 3.
Yeah.
But it was punishment. Every time it was intro tech class, the teachers love to flog. I know. Yes. My teacher, God rest his soul. The man they flog. It was as if, this is not my calling in life. My brother said I will be a lawyer. Okay. Do you understand me?
Yeah.
But you see, I had classmates who intro tech was fun. Once it's intro tech, you see them smiling. Most of them are in the vocational field today. I had classmates that enjoyed intro tech.
One of my friends, Brainbox, we call him Brainbox in secondary school, Nigerian Navy secondary school, by the way. Shout out Brainbox. He said that when after secondary school, he was going to go to the university. His brother said he's not going. His brother said, no, he's not going. He wants to go, he's an Igbo boy, traditional Igbo boy. He wants to go learn trade. He told Brainbox, his elder brother, told the junior one, who is my classmate, told him, come, let's go learn this trade. Oh, yes. By the time you're done with university, you go don't get cash. No, we go learn this thing. He said, no, he wants to go. He went to university 6 years, studied Aki, and after we met, his brother owns like fleets of shops in Alaba International Market, controlling nothing less than, you know this guy, nothing less than half a billion. Mm. And he said that, Frank, one of the greatest regrets, he was a graduate, he told me then, I remember that particular spot on the road, we were just walking, and he told me, Frank, one of the greatest regrets in his life was that he did not listen to his brother to join him in this Unwa boy trade he talked about. He said right now, his brother, if you see him, he wears bedroom slippers all the time. Now, they always sponsor our chilling that time. And he said, his brother, if he needs funding for any project to the tune of 400 million, with a twinkle of an eye, he can raise it. He said he, even this fund for 50K, he still depends on his brother as a graduate. So and he do you know the funny thing? He ended up doing the Umwa boy for his brother. After 4 years of university, now he's controlling some funds.
So let me tell you a secret.
Brand box 19.
So let me tell you a secret. You know what these businesses do? They don't build on investor funds. They build on numbers. Nigerians are consuming. They bear the product, they market it to the consuming market, and they sell it. Sell, 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 keep selling, keep selling, keep selling. Go back, get feedback, reinvent, sell again. Go back, get feedback, reinvent, sell again.
Do you know what these guys sell? Light. Stage light. All your concerts in Lagos supply those lights.
Why? They found numbers. You know, you can't underestimate the place of a market. If you come to tell me about your startup, the first thing I ask you is about your market. I'm more interested in your market. And if you are not clear as to the market you want to service, you're joking.
I would love us to just go into, we're about rounding up. We have barely a few minutes. I would love us to go into networking.
I thought we're just getting started.
Yeah, we're about rounding up. That's how interesting the Frankly Business Podcast can be, actually. But yeah, you've demystified the myth around networking, because you do it effortlessly. I don't know whether it's by virtue of what you do, but you are not the only one who ends up doing what you do. You've been able to crack that code of networking, and it's one of the anchor of businesses in 21st century business. It's the anchor. There is one of my apostles will say that even God, if he wants to bless you, he will bless you through men.
Mm-hmm.
And so you need men in everything you do around life. And so networking is the bane of business. To get investors, you need networking. To get customers, mm-hmm. you need networking. Mm-hmm. To get staff members, mm-hmm. you also need networking. How do you do it? I need to sit on the floor and learn.
No, so networking is the product of upbringing.
Hmm.
If you're raised right, you learn how to relate to people.
So for those who are not raised right, are you saying there's no way around it?
No, so let me explain. Yeah. Networking starts with as simple as greeting.
Hmm.
Learning how to greet. Good morning. Let me tell you, Kenneth, if every day I go to my office and I see you and I say, good morning, good morning, good morning. One day you say, hi, what's your name? What do you do? Right, okay. Oh, you're a lawyer. Oh, and I was just even thinking of doing XYZ. Can I have your number? That's where it starts. But you see, a lot of people see networking from a place of need. I want to go to Chivido wedding because I will meet people who will help my business grow. Have you studied the people that are going there? What value do you want to give them? Many people who network wrongly because they've not built personal capacity. So my team in the firm keeps saying, oh, I should bring more business because I know so many people. I say, no, we're building capacity in some spirit. That I know Frank, and I know Frank can give me this brief, and I can ask him and he'll give me immediately. I won't ask him until I'm sure I have the capacity to deliver. Because if Frank gives me and I can't deliver, I would have ruined the relationship. So building capacity is one of the most important tools in networking. Before, I best believe, you see me talking to somebody, I'm marketing a value.
Not your product.
I am making a contribution. I am trying to improve what that person is doing. So I listen to a speaker who is speaking, I get talking points, and the next thing I'm saying, oh, I'm very I was very intrigued by this point that you have raised. And I actually think that this will help this sector of the economy, or this will help this demography. And I think that this is what I'm going to make short notes and share with those people. And I'm sure to give you a feedback as to what they think. And the person is like, wow, it's different from coming and saying, can I have your card, sir? I really, really enjoyed what you said. God bless you. Do you understand me?
Yeah.
Marketing today has also gone beyond value proposition. I know how to do this. You don't pass. There are 100 people that are doing what we are doing. So beyond the value you want to give, how are you able to deliver it in such a way that the person does not feel like you just want to get something from his pocket? Another word that is abused is mentorship. Today, someone sees Kenan on the podcast, he wants to grow beard like him and sit up and say, come on, he's like, Kenan, come on, make me your mentor. I want you to be my mentor. Then Kenan says, no, no worries, I have a few shoots, come follow me. And then Kenan calls him at 10 o'clock, sir, it's raining, no, my street is flooded, I can't make it. You won't be mentor. You know, and then on another day, okay, come, all right, sit down. And then you sit and wait for 10 hours. Why Kenne is having different things and all that. And then, you know, Kenne drops you off. We remind you. Just carry me, sit down here. What kind of thing is this? He did not even introduce me to Frank. He did not even introduce me. They were even eating donuts. He did not give me. You want to be a mentee. You think it will come on a platter. Here we work. The problem is that people don't want to work. So that mentee wants to come and you introduce him to plan. In fact, wants you to shift and give him chair beside you without learning. And so, if I don't see any value, I go for events that I pay a lot to attend and I have not been able to extricate the value I want to discuss with people. I don't mentor.
Whoa.
I just get what I want to do and go home. I don't, because if I'm not able to add value to the conversation and show how I can actually make your life better or how we can actually collaborate to build something impactful, it's not a sense of networking. Listen, complimentary card is one of the most useless pieces of paper you can ever have. If there's no history behind it, I'll give you my complimentary. You call me, who are you? When did I give you my card? That's what you hear. But if there's shared value, you will just see, and let me shock you. When you have this value-driven conversation with people you're networking with, even when you offer their card, the next thing they are saying is handing you their phone, enter your number. I met a very influential person in this country. You can't call 10 people without calling them. After our conversation, the next thing he did was he took his phone, he took my picture, he saved my number, you know, put my picture. So he said, so when you call, I see your face. So I know it's you. Value. Guess what? We had the same card. In fact, also, you have to be careful. You can't go and see someone at the top and you'll be giving the person your card. Who are you? So if the person gives you and if the person asks, you can.
Yeah.
But when I looked at his card and I looked at the number that he had given me, it was different. Which means now PA number I didn't get or Koro number. But today we're together. I post on WhatsApp, he will comment. In fact, Christmas, he will first send me Merry Christmas flyer. You don't want to know the business component to it. In fact, someone reached out to me to speak at an event, and it was really tight for me. Really, really tight. I was traveling. I had to be in court. It's just so much wrapped up that day. And I asked my team to send my apologies. And the person sent a message to me and said, this person said the only reason he will sponsor this conference is if you are speaking. So I'm sorry, sir, please. And he didn't speak to me. This is my mentor now, did not even mention it to me. Because I was wondering, how did this guy get my address, everything, and all that? Yeah. But they had even done a flyer.
Yeah.
And I was like, what effrontery? Right? But he had already told them that the only way I'll sponsor is if this guy comes to speak in your conference.
They are men and they are men.
So That's networking. That's mentorship. For you to open your mouth and say you want to be mentored, you must be ready to work. You must be ready to work without gratification, without anything. My mentors will ask me, are you okay? In the early years when I started, are you all right? Do you have trust money? I don't have trust money. I said, I'm fine, sir. I will trek. I will trek because my boss money can only get me from Obalende to Yaba. So I will trek from Ikoyi to Obalende rather than say I don't have transport money. This is global television, right? I can stand to say I have never asked anything from any mentor. Never, not one. Even when I've been in the middle of it. But the truth is, when you build a relationship with them, they become subsumed in your life. They get to know you, that even when you're having challenges, they see it. My mentor called me, one of my mentors, she called me, and she just started talking of fitness, exercise, this. When she finished, she said, I see you have added a lot of weight. She's watching my status. So I see you've added a lot of weight. So do this. This is somebody that's sitting on billion-dollar businesses. But they have time for you because you have invested in the relationship. They ask you to do stuff, you do it, you don't ask for money. We don't have that here. Let me send that little boy to go and buy me Coke now. He will come back with change. He will give me the Coke. We will bring the change. The Coke will be here. The change will be here. So once I collect the Coke, some will tell you thank you before you even give it. Thank you, sir, for the change. I didn't give it to you. Give it to me and return it. If we don't build that system where you can delay gratification, what's going to happen? You have a system of entitled people milling around. The first proof of mentorship is someone who is willing to go through without asking for anything. Oh, so you as a mentor must take them through a difficult process and see if they will stay. See if they will show. If I have a meeting and it's raining and you give me an excuse because of rain, cancel. Enter that rain. Come to me drenched. Then I know you're ready. Because guess what? If the U.S. Embassy was going to give you a visa, if heaven was falling, you would get to the front of the embassy, except your village will swear for you. That's the level of energy you must bring into building relationships, whether networking or mentorship.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen.
But Frank, before we go, we forgot to ask him a question.
Okay.
Who would you love for us to bring next? What question should we ask the person?
Okay.
Bring Cardozo and ask him to bring down why he has not brought down NPR rates. But really, I would want you to bring a traditional businessman. Talking of Franklin Business, I've seen all your podcasts. You are bringing Senere, go to Alaba. Bring a traditional businessman who's been in the game for 20 years, who started in one cubicle, and now has plazas, and tell them to tell you their story. 90% of the time, they are still in that cubicle where they started. That's still where they report to every day, but they have plazas they maintain. There's a story that you and I need to learn.
Bye-bye. Like, bye.
Bye.
Bye. That's all. I'll just drop this mic, that's all. You've heard it. We'll do that. We'll do just that. Traditional businessman. Kelechi, what do you have to tell the people?
Like, subscribe, share. Get more value. And let's get more guests.
It's been a great time having a conversation on the Frankly Business Podcast with the doyen of the startup ecosystem. I want to say thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. It was fun for coming to our famous couch. Cheers. I'll see you on the other side of the next episode of Frankly Business Podcast.